part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we're going to take a look at healthcare in our final years. Our guest is Dr. Joanne Lynn. She's a leader in helping people who are terminally ill improve their quality of life. Her expertise includes serious chronic illnesses and public policy. And she says healthcare and community services fall short of the needs of people who face a prolonged period of progressive illness and disability before death. Dr. Lynn is the author of several books on healthcare, including Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore, Reforming Healthcare for the Last Years of Life. This comes from the introduction to that book, Dysfunctions That Result from Outdated Healthcare and Social Arrangements Cause Fear and Suffering for Most of Us, both when we try to help a family member or friend with a fatal illness and when we ourselves are ill. Sometimes a person dies peaceably and gracefully at the end of a long life. Everyone concerned considers this person to have been lucky, precisely because all of us know that the last part of life so often includes untreated pain, financial disaster, loss of control, frustrating struggles with disabilities, and even a generally miserable and purposeless last chapter. That comes from the introduction to Joanne Lynn's book, Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore. Now, here's the sentence that begins the next paragraph. It doesn't have to be this way. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Joanne Lynn. She's been a physician serving people living out the end of life in hospices, nursing homes, private homes, and hospitals. She is director of the Washington Home Center for Palliative Care Studies, senior scientist at the RAND Corporation, and president of Americans for Better Care of the Dying. Her book, Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore, Reforming Healthcare for the Last Years of Life, is published by the University of California Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, that the number for the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
We can do better. Some people live well with serious illness, so as you ask at the outset of this book, why can't we all have a good ending?
Well, mostly because we haven't cared to try. I mean, it's actually fairly straightforward and not terribly expensive or difficult to achieve, at least for most people. Obviously, there are always some difficult cases. But an awful lot of the reason we have such dysfunction is that we have tricked ourselves into thinking that we're just fighting a series of acute illnesses, and somehow if we could just wipe them each out one by one, something truly wonderful would happen. We've never been quite explicit about what that truly wonderful would be, but it denies the fact that almost all of us will eventually get a very bad illness, will live a long time with it, and will die from it. And that during that piece of time, we need a care system that looks rather different, that accepts the limitations, supports people and their families, makes sure they live comfortably and without bankrupting themselves, and die as gracefully and with as meaningful a last phase of life as we can find. Mostly, we just haven't paid attention.
Why do you suppose we're not paying attention?
Well, you know, we inherited a care system just a generation ago in which it was uncommon to grow old and die slow. 100 years ago, the average woman who made it to adulthood died of a complication of having children, and the average man of a complication of working. You know, we forget that the median age at death in 1900 was only 46. So we haven't had a very long time in which we have large numbers of people who get to live a long time with heart disease, with lung disease, with bad kidneys, with dementia, with frailty, with whatever. And those things are going to cause long-term disability on the order of an average now of about 2 years. And that just wasn't the case. I mean, there were people who obviously traveled that course, but they were unusual. They were the rare great-grandmother. Now almost everybody who's listening to this show expects to be a great-grandmother or great-grandfather, assuming you had children at all. You certainly expect to live that long. Mm. And mostly, we don't have the stories, we don't have the structures, we don't have the way of putting our system together. You know, we built the care system around the possibility that we needed to pay for surgery. Well, you know, we do pay for surgery, and we have almost no one in old age who can keep a hernia if they want it, because doctors can make a living on getting rid of it. But if what you need is spoon-fed every day for 3 years, good luck. Yeah. We never put that into our calculations.
Yeah. So we're
in large part because in 1960 there just weren't very many people who lived very long that sick.
Yeah. So in a sense, the changes we've seen over how we come to life's end have been relatively rapid, but also somehow or other it seems to me that you could also say they've been gradual.
Well, I guess that's always the case. but, you know, in terms of a culture coming to terms with a very different demographic, it is fairly rapid. One of my lovely old ladies was telling me as I was making a hurried set of rounds on Christmas Day a decade or two ago, she looked at me and said, I've always turned to the Bible in times like this when I wasn't sure how to live my life, and there's always been a story that could pull me through. Mm. And I said, in a hurry, you'll forgive me, I said, how about Job? And she looked at me in that wonderful way that an older lady has of telling you that you are way out of line, and said, Job lived. Mm. And she's absolutely right. No one in the Bible died after years and years and years of living in a fragile balance between health care and the constraints of their life. You know, 100 years ago, you would have had to been able to make it out to the outhouse. You know, you would have had to been able to endure a draft. You would have to have been able to endure an infection. And, now the end of life, the last few years, are ordinarily a very fragile balance with the demands of our environment, in which medical and health care props us up, but in a sense we are waiting for a stumble. And the stumble doesn't have to be very big. It just has to be one that the props fail at keeping you upright. So the dying is kind of a sudden thing in the course of a very fragile life. And we haven't thought through what a good care system would look like. I think if we did, we'd start with obvious things like continuity.
Yeah.
Why is it that if you go in pregnant at 4 weeks pregnant, you get hooked up with a care team that's going to last clear through the delivery and until you're kind of back on your feet? And yet if you go in unable to breathe with heart failure, you may never see the same doctor again. You may see a different doctor, in some situations almost daily, sometimes almost hourly. Nobody knows you, your family. Nobody comes to your home. That's just a wrong-headed way of putting that together.
Yeah.
And yet we don't value that. We don't pay more for care systems that make continuity a central tenet, that make rapid response to the home an important priority, or even that make symptom management an important priority. You know, you can go online and find out all kinds of things about where to find a cancer center for chemotherapy, but good luck finding one that's good at keeping you out of pain.
Yeah. We have a listener.
We just haven't lived with it long enough. We need to work on it a little.
Yeah. Sounds like we need to work on it quite a bit. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Joanne Lynn. She is the author of Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore, Reforming Healthcare for the Last Years of Life. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone in Urbana. Caller on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm on a cell, so I just have a couple of observations, and I'll hang up and wait for your comments. Received my graduate degree in public health from UIC in Chicago about 15 years ago, and if I gleaned anything out of those studies, it was long-term care insurance, which I then tried to turn around and educate my father, and, well, I might as well have been speaking Chinese. My dad lived a long life till 92, but sure enough, used up 80% of the cost of his medical care in the last 20% of his life, and he went through his estate pretty rapidly between nursing homes and hospitals, and he wasn't about to get long-term care insurance, but I was wondering if your guest could speak on the good or the ills of that. You know, it's an uphill struggle, but being involved with it straight away, it's amazing the cost that a person incurs in the last part of their life, and most people, almost everyone, is not prepared for that, and it's really quite a tragic situation. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks for raising that. Long-term care insurance is an idea that has yet to gel. As mostly marketed, it is too expensive to actually solve our long-term care problems. The average person who is in a family that is headed by a white person who has worked most of their life has only a little over $100,000 in assets at the time of retirement. The cost for a couple of long-term care insurance would have completely consumed that. So it's unreasonable to think that a majority of people are going to be able to buy long-term care insurance without some kind of subsidy. On the other hand, as soon as you get to two, three, four people, the odds of needing long-term care and very expensive long-term care become overwhelming. It's not like a fire that you'd insure for because one in every 5 or 10,000 houses might burn down, but it's much more virtually predictable. It is more commonly needed, incidentally, by women than men because women mostly outlive their spouses. So women on average have 7 years of widowhood. And they've mostly provided care for their husbands for free. So the group that most needs long-term care insurance are women who also have lower incomes and lower opportunities to buy into it. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be saving for long-term care. It means that we probably have to explore some other ways of going about it. Effectively, Medicaid is our long-term care insurance for the vast majority of us. We will spend down to the point at which we have no assets. Our families will kick in for some, but the costs are just overwhelming, and eventually Medicaid will be the one that chips in. There's a group just beyond that that do all manner of really pretty dysfunctional things trying to avoid that spend down because they have a little more assets. If there were a way for that group to even buy into subsidized long-term care, even at the Medicaid level of service, it would be a major boon. But we have to start thinking about this in a coherent way. You know, we use Medicare Part A to pay hospitals, Medicare Part B to pay doctors, and we think of those as entitlements that do not turn on your wealth. And now we're going to add Medicare Part D to pay for your drugs. But we cover your housing and your direct care of the body by private assets first until they're all gone, and then by Medicaid. And the first game in any public policy endeavor is to shift costs from one to the other, rather than to say, no, wait a minute, many of us are going to be in this population. We actually need to have a coherent policy that sees the cost of hospitalization, the cost of drugs, the cost of doctors, the cost of housing, the cost of direct care, all in one pot. There are some demonstrations and some small programs that are doing this, but it's not at the center of our thinking yet. As this gentleman points out, he says his father spent 80% of everything he ever spent on medical care in his last 20% mm-hmm. of his life. And that's a little more than has been documented as a disparity, but it's not far off. It appears that something on the order of half of everything we spend is in the last 10% of our lives. And I think if we brought that front and center and sort of had it in the middle of the front page of newspapers and in stories, we might start making some different decisions. We might start prioritizing that the nursing home be really lovely and be willing to give up on one last effort to revive the heart or to forfend the cancer or something else that's very expensive in return for having reliable services to make sure we can live gracefully and fittingly within the envelope of a fatal disease.
Yeah. I want to cite some figures that you cite in your book that can really, I think, quickly really make this so clear to us. As far as Medicaid goes, in fiscal year 2000, Medicaid paid for 45% of the $137 billion annual cost of institutional long-term care. Medicare's payments average about $28,000 in the last year of a person's life. And while costs earlier in life show substantial disparities, Medicare's costs for the last year of life average almost the same for the poor and the rich. So we're all,
once you're this sick, you get what medicine has to offer.
Yeah, and we are all then really, when it comes down to it, at the end of life in the same boat, or most of us are.
Well, and the ordinary person cannot reasonably be expected to save prudently for, in a sense, losing at the roulette game and having 7 years of profound disability after a stroke and needing institutional long-term care throughout. We have this image somehow that families should all rally and take care of one another, but taking care of family members is now the leading cause of bankruptcy for old women. They will have taken time off toward the end of their work life. That will cut into their pensions and their Social Security. The current revisions proposed for Social Security would even make this worse because they would limit the degree to which you get a spouse benefit. The retirement security, savings, long-term care insurance, and health care in the last few years of life are all intertwined, and each of us is on a roulette that somehow people have this sense that they'll just sort of live to a ripe old age and suddenly quit. Well, the suddenly quit is now down to under 5% of us. The rest of us get cancer, stroke, heart disease, lung disease, dementia, or frailty, and just those six occupy more than 80% of all dying. Yeah. So none of those are cheap ways out. they're all expensive. And to the extent that we get better at delaying the onset of cancer, heart disease, and lung disease by living healthier, by stopping smoking, by getting better screening, we actually increase our long-term care costs because we're more likely to grow old, frail, mobility impaired, or demented, and needing lots more personal care.
Yeah.
So these kinds of equations may sound grim until you hold them up against dying at 45. Nobody actually wants to go back to having scourges that come through the community and kill many people in young ages. It's a wonderful thing to get to grow old before mm-hmm. dying. It just ought to be comfortable and appropriate, and we ought to be able to count on the community having put together a care system that makes sense. Why is it that it's easier for me to get a patient in the intensive care unit than it is for me to get a meal delivered on a weekend? It's easier for me to get a hip replaced than to have respite care for a family who needs some support for a week or two. You know, we have the priorities on backwards by the time you get this old, sick, and frail.
Yeah. One of the things that you say in the book is that public health, our public health priorities, aim at preventing and controlling disease, injury, and disability. But you say, but among very sick or old people, these measures are inadequate and possibly misleading. So I have a number of questions here. The first one is, how and why is this misleading?
Well, we talk about prevention as if we're still talking about polio. I'm just barely old enough to remember the last polio epidemic in my little town in West Virginia, where the swimming area was shut down and kids died in the high school. And it was a truly wonderful thing for polio to be gone, for there to be no more such thing. And the children who did not face polio truly got their lives back. They would live a long life. They would face no other problem from this. But if you look at the language we use when we talk about preventing heart disease or preventing colon cancer or preventing strokes, we use the same language. And while I'm all in favor of prevention, and there's, you know, people are always saying, oh, but you know, you're just a cynic about this, I say, no, but it really is the case that there is something silly about doing a mammogram on a very elderly lady who will die of her dementia within 3 years. The time course of breast cancer is longer than her lifespan. And you know, so preventing breast cancer in that population has become a silly endeavor. Maybe occasionally it actually does some good, but on the whole, it just wastes money. What we should be worrying about at that part of our lives, and I use the first person plural with some note because it's all of us in the future, is preventing pain, preventing disability, maintaining interactions with the people we love and care about as long as possible, doing the things that are important in wrapping up a life, but being willing to say, you know, it just doesn't matter anymore to spend a lot of money lowering lipids or screening for cancers that have long survival times. It'd be much more important to keep the person in good shoes. But the idea that there comes a phase of your life when your priorities are quite appropriately different than they were when you were 42 seems to come hard to us. You know, my very old patients, of course, find this perfectly obvious. But yeah, most of us involved in policy are still, you know, 52 and think we'll live forever. I think it's somehow somebody else's problem. And I think as we live through taking care of our parents, we have the opportunity to wake up and redesign care around the population that's to be served. So you should have a care system that looks different for maternal fetal health rather than for middle-aged people with low-grade chronic illness, and different from the major ways one lives through the last piece of life. You know, this is the most expensive part of life. At the point at which you are, let's say, demented enough to no longer be able to be alone, maybe still ambulatory but incontinent, unable to make any sense or know what day it is, remember yesterday or anticipate tomorrow, you know, what are your priorities at that point? And while we may have some interesting philosophic debate on some of the issues, there's an awful lot on which there'd be easy accord. We don't want to get skin breakdown. We don't want to be tied to a bed. Mm. We don't want to be ignored and not fed. We don't want to have dental abscesses or to be left in an undignified way. We'd like our families to be able to remember us with some grace. And then you say, well, would you want an implanted device to regulate your heart rhythm? And you know, most older people look at you like you're out of your mind. And yet, what's right now paid for and readily available is the device and not the other things.
Oh. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Joanne Lynn. She's a leader in helping people who are terminally ill improve their quality of life. She's director of the Washington Home Center for Palliative Care Studies, senior scientist at the Rand Corporation, and president of Americans for Better Care, of the dying. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I'm fine. You?
Oh, pretty good. My mother died about 1993, and she died very quickly, and I was in and out of hospice. I spent the evenings with her and stuff like that, and it was sort of fortunate now that I realized that she did not, you know, hang in there. She had terminal liver cancer, and my mother-in-law's second husband is dying basically right now, and it's amazing the difference in the attitudes of the people. I mean, she's got this thing about, you know, say, you know, every little thing she can do, pouring huge amounts of money in this guy. I mean, I do like him as a person, but I'm seeing the absurdity of what you're talking about. I look at it and think, it's not because I don't like him or anything. I just think, why are they doing all of this? And but I wanted to say that Joan Didion has written a book about her husband's death, and I read a review of it, and a quote from the book said that when she found out her daughter was very ill, she said, now that I think about it, I acted like a child wishing I could just make it all go away or change the outcome. And I think, in a way, what you're talking about seems to be like the culture is doing that. That, you know, people are going to die. Yes, we know that. But let's drag it out as long as we can, because death is bad. And I just find that just a really interesting social concept.
Yeah, the idea that we do this mainly because we can't come to terms with death is certainly something we should need to examine.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, that we probably could do somewhat better. I challenge the listeners to think of any character on evening television who's been allowed to develop a character and has been on the show for more than a few weeks, who's living with a fatal condition entailing substantial disability and suffering.
Yeah.
And you'll really scratch your head.
Yeah,
there are a couple, but they're pretty obscure, and they're mostly on HBO. We don't even tell the stories, even around the water cooler, of how we assess this and what makes sense. It's not part of our shared experience. So every family comes at it thinking they're the very first ones.
Mm. Oh,
and
yeah.
They think that somehow it's all going to be terribly clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that the doctor continues to convey some ambiguity means that that the good person reaches for every possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to come to terms with understanding that the course is eventually fatal. The precise timing is what's unclear.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how can you live the very best life you can in whatever time remains to you without prioritizing the extension of time? I've seen people go through such anguish trying to eke out an extra month that they've given up the 3 good months they could have had.
Oh, yeah. No,
over and over again.
Yeah, and you know, there was a film, French-Canadian film called Barbarians at the Gate, which was a simplified view that the guy committed suicide, invited all of his friends, and typical with the French-speaking view, invited his mistresses to sit around and have wine with him, and then he killed himself. But also, I wanted to say something. You were talking about the financial end of this. And after going through this a couple of times with relatives, I've sort of come up with this cynical statement that it's compassion on someone else's dime. And I don't know. I look around and think, this enormous, like you were talking about, the statistical, the numbers, the amount of money they spend on people's last, you know, year of their lives or 6 months. And you think about how, and I think you're exactly right, and that reallocation of money and the acceptance of a better end, which is really what this is about, a better end, would be so much more practical and so much more reasonable. And thanks for your trouble.
I think we could get a fair distance if we even started making this a much more political issue. How is it that we managed to debate Medicare modernization as if the only issue was drugs? You know, the at least as big an issue is this one. Medicare modernization has to deal with the fact that the baby boomers are all going to get old together. And we have about 20 years until the boomers are all starting to get sick at the same time. And we will double the number of people terribly sick at the same time. If we have only our present arrangements, we are going to bankrupt so many families, and we are going to leave people in such a lurch that I think we will either learn to walk out on one another or to allow people to commit suicide or in some other way to cut this short. Whereas on the other hand, we really could put together a set of arrangements that would make sure that people could live out the end of life with some grace and dignity and meaning and on their own terms. There's a marvelous new report by the President's Council on Bioethics dealing with caregiving, dementia, and aging that calls on the country to put together a national commission, a presidential commission, to pull together these data in a much more authoritative way and to test out the options so that we could use this 10 or 15 years before the numbers start to really climb to get in place the care system we need. I think that would be the kind of thing that would really serve us well rather than just running up the drug bill, running up the device bill, sending people to the hospital without stepping back to say, but wait a minute, is this actually how we want to live out these last few years? And I would love to have the chance to have substantial groups of those most affected weigh in as to what their priorities are and then try to build a care system around those priorities. We think that there are three basic trajectories of the last year of life that you would have to plan around. One is the relatively short course to death that this gentleman describes with cancer, in which the person knows they have cancer for a long time, but they're really only sick for a few weeks or a few months. And this is where hospice can really excel, putting in a great deal of services very quickly and supporting the family mostly at home. A second trajectory is the people mostly with heart and lung disease who go in and out of the hospital over and over again and often think they're waiting for cancer. But in fact, of course, one of these episodes is going to get them, and it will seem sudden, although in a statistical sense it was predictable all along. And they need planning, contingent planning. They need to be able to get services at home when they get close to the end. And then there's the much larger group, the group we mostly try to turn our eyes from, of those who just have lived a very long time. And they usually have multifactorial disease. They usually have arthritis and hearing problems and vision problems or instability or heart disease. And a half will also have a dementing illness where they will not be able to take care of themselves. And here you especially need that hands-on care, support to the family. But you can readily see how if you could build the care system around those three cases, you would serve almost everybody. And we could do that in any city. Any city, Champaign-Urbana could decide to build a care system that was reliable for those three trajectories and take care of almost everybody. And I'm pretty sure that it would be at a slightly lower cost than we are now putting into the system on a per capita basis. Obviously, when you get many more people, we are going to raise the cost some. But if we could keep the costs from growing, it would be a major service.
Yeah. Have hospice and comfort care helped us reexamine our priorities, broaden our priorities to better address the needs of the very sick and the very old?
Oh, yes. I was a physician in 1978, probably one of the first dozen hospice physicians. And at that time, people came to us never having been given any morphine-type drugs, in terrible pain, having been bounced from one treatment to another. This was almost all cancer, and never having been comfortable for sometimes a year or more, and just no longer even able to respond, just overwhelmed by pain. Hospice has taught us that nobody needs to be in that circumstance, that we can always find a way to have the person be at least tolerably comfortable. They may not be feeling great, but they are not in just overwhelming pain. Hospice has taught us a lot about continuity, about family support, about the need for bereavement care. On the other hand, the way we constructed hospice is not particularly good for taking care of people with dementia or people with strokes who may stay stable for a long time. It was designed around this idea of putting in a tremendous array of services for a very short time, no more than a couple months. And the endurance of the long run that it takes to live out the end of life with frailty, advanced old age, dementia, requires a different rhythm of services, but many of the same principles.
Yeah, I've got a couple of more listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go first to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just helped my stepdad through the dying process with dementia and pancreatic cancer. And there was a lot to learn. And I wanted to share a resource, which is a short book by a longtime hospice nurse called Dying, a Natural Process. It's $15 plus shipping. It's only 40 pages long, and it's she can be reached at the email address, densysc@cybermesa.com. Her point is that part of what we fear is that we don't know what's going to be happening, and she thinks that we need to know more about the actual process of dying so that we can sort of relax into the process and have some of the idea of what's going on. What I found to be, I didn't have the book at the time this was that my stepdad was dying, but it was, I had never dealt with somebody who was incontinent before, and it's, you know, odor and the constant having to deal with it, and with somebody who has dementia, it just became overwhelming for my mom and me. Nobody talks about these things because, you know, they seem so private and so personal, and oh, in some ways, I guess it's kind of like airing your dirty laundry or something,
so to speak.
But but I was pleased. I was pleased that we at least forewent surgery, because there was a surgeon willing to do surgery, and he's very positive about it. And I said to him, "Look, you know, we've got somebody who's elderly, he's frail, and I don't know that it makes sense to subject somebody to surgery that has a 20% cure rate on somebody who's even younger than that." Just recently in, I think it was the first issue of August of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, there was an article about death and dying. And one of the things it said was that we often try to, we feel like we have to fight the battle, otherwise we're giving in. And it pointed out that a lot of times when people do that, what they do is they make the death, the thing that causes the death can often be worse than what seems to be causing it now, by postponing death and acting as though it's optional. I thought that was an interesting point of view. It seems we have so much to learn. And you know, I've said to people, my elders in my family used to say that pneumonia used to be the old person's friend, and that it took somebody fairly quickly. And yet, if I mention that to people, they say, "Oh, that's a horrible death, and it's so painful." And I thought, you know, why does it need to be painful if you can manage it with morphine or whatever, and if it helps take a person humanely and relatively quickly? And do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, thank you very much for calling. There are a number of good resources now. I'm glad you found one that helped you put this all together. If people want to go to the web, look at growthhouse.org. It has put together a tremendous portal that links you to everywhere else on the web that's reputable. So if you're sort of looking to where to start, go to growthhouse.org. We also have a book that's been very well received called The Handbook for Mortals, which is a little longer than the book you describe, but is written for the public and helps walk people through these unfamiliar things. You know, how do you talk to a doctor? How do you deal with Medicare and Medicaid? How do you find help for symptoms? How do you deal with funerals? You know, the kinds of things that people are really finding quite novel and difficult. So there are, I think, more and more resources. You do have to be able to dig a little. They don't yet show up, you know, sort of in Newsweek and Women's Day. They are, you have to kind of go out of your way to look for them. In terms of dealing with things like the incontinence and how to find out about that, we are the worst country among developed countries in supporting family caregivers. Every other country provides an array of services, training, in-home nursing, respite care, health insurance, disability insurance, sometimes supplies. And instead, we sort of make families go it on their own and learn very difficult things over the care of somebody they love. And again, if we had our priorities straight, it would seem that one of the things we would most want to do would be to help families learn what they need to learn to reliably take care of people, and to feel confident about it, and to provide the concrete supports. I mean, there is something really cruel about a woman at 58 taking off work to take care of her mother as she goes through dementia and ending up going bare with no health insurance. You know, she's doing such a service for the community mm-hmm. by being the loyal daughter. Surely we ought to at least allow her to buy into Medicaid or Medicare rather than having to spend down herself to poverty in order to get any health care for herself. Again, no other Western country does it this way. I mean, it's as if we sort of had this frontier spirit on the backs of women who do not get, I say women because, of course, 80% of the care is given by women, who have not been asked about it, you know, who have not had a chance to negotiate this issue. They're facing their mother's dementia and have to do something to cope. It seems like there was something else this caller had, but I can't remember what it was, and I didn't make a note. So get back to me if it comes back to you.
Okay. We're running down on time. Let's take another call before we're out of time. A listener in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm reminded of all the physical and technical things that you've been speaking of, but in terms of the personal, emotional, and spiritual aspects, I'm thinking of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the earlier years that addressed some of the matters of, that we are becoming aware of personally and all the other people. And then the doctor who wrote the book Kitchen Table Wisdom gave such a wonderful insight and support to the situation that people may have to go through. And however, bringing you up to date, I'm concerned with the president speaking today, addressing this press conference about the possibility of things beyond our control, such as have occurred with the tsunami, Katrina, and Rita hurricanes, and the potential of, like I said, avian flu, a pandemic, and other things, where things may be beyond our control, so that, and then what with the government now saying there's such a shortage of technical nursing and other facility support for the near future into the point where I think they said 50,000 to 100,000 people are certainly needed in the near future to even bringing up the hospital administrative things into a functional way, let alone anything that is more disastrous that may be on the horizon. So I thank you very much for the wonderful program you've been having, but the other things are well worth looking into and exploring. Thank you very much.
Okay, want to make a comment?
Yeah, you know, we can ignore the spiritual and very often even the emotional aspects of many illnesses. You know, a person gets a gallbladder attack and we mostly can ignore their sense of fragility in the hand of fate because they're going to be well and whatever issues they need to take up, they can take up themselves. In taking care of very sick people who are coming to the end of their lives, spiritual, emotional, family issues really do become central. In one study, the highest rated single service that people wanted to have as they died was to have another person present, just to have their hand held. We really do need to pay attention to the needs to wrap up a life, to be able to say goodbyes, to leave a legacy, tell your story, say thanks. And those things are really hard to do in hospital intensive care units or emergency ambulances. We need to figure out how to, in a sense, have a rebirth of community so that people who are facing this have the support of neighbors and churches and school kids, and we're more in it together. And then I think we can pull it off. I think we really could take care of one another, even through the boomers all getting old together. But if we just make it a crass, you know, get the services you pay for, we're going to bankrupt ourselves and not like it either. So this is a chance, it seems, and maybe Katrina and Rita and other things are stresses on the community that we could learn to, in a sense, rise above and reorganize. You know, we have no disaster planning for this population. We don't plan to use long-term care facilities and institutions, and yet we could. This is part of the community. There are more long-term care facilities by far than there are hospitals. So bringing this experience out into the open, talking about it, figuring out what would really what would a really good community do in terms of this new demographic. Mm. And that's what we're mostly pushing for in the book, Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore, is really a call for family caregivers to mobilize, to develop a strong agenda of the kinds of changes that we need to have in order to secure a peaceful, meaningful life in those last few years. That's the sort of thing that I think we deserve, and it wouldn't cost any more. It's just a matter of having some focus on it.
Yeah. It sounds like not only do we need individual advanced care directives, but also a collective societal advanced planning session or several sessions are called for.
There's a citizens working group on healthcare reform that is part of the Medicare Modernization Act, and when it comes through your area, go show up and testify in next year's elections. Start pushing people who are running for office to read my book, to take a stand. What are you willing to do? I think that in the current round of thinking about paying doctors and hospitals differently, we should start thinking about paying for continuity, just staying with the person throughout. And we ought to start figuring out how to meld long-term care in with the rest of healthcare in a way that makes sense for the community. These are very important things because all of us are going to be there. You know, very few of us are going to be hit by a truck or suddenly die at 62. You know, the vast majority of us are going to live through a substantial period of time, a few months to a few years, of very expensive care. At the present time, our families will be driven to distraction. We will be driven into bankruptcy. We will suffer symptoms we didn't need to see. We will have available all kinds of expensive services we didn't need. We won't have the ones we do need. Seems like we could do a whole lot better than that. And we have on the order of 10 years to get to start getting a good care system in place, and on the order of about 20 years before we're utterly swamped. So that's the challenge. Could we make it? Could we find the places to do the demonstrations, to try things out, to push our politicians, to learn how to forge alliances so that there really is a strong public voice? Almost all of end-of-life care is now paid for by the federal government. It's Medicare, Medicaid, the Veterans Administration, Social Security. It's a public issue whether we wanted it to be or not. So that does give us some leverage to fix it.
Mm.
So check out Americans for Better Care of the Dying on the web. I'm actually no longer the president because we're trying to move it toward a much more activist consumer voice. So I'm on the board, but I think you'll find there some very interesting policy agenda, push the AARP, push disease organizations, cancer societies, Alzheimer's associations, to really get an agenda in this arena. It isn't enough just to do research to prevent the diseases. We still are going to get something bad. So let's have that period of time while living with something bad be rewarding and worthwhile and not just sort of thrown away time that's left to be miserable. Mm.
There we have to leave it. Dr. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Joanne Lynn has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of a number of books on health care, including the one that we've been talking about this afternoon, Sick to Death and Not Going to Take It Anymore, Reforming Health Care for the Last Years of Life. The book is published by the University of California Press. 5 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Tuesday afternoon, futures in the beaten pit settling between 13 and 18 and a half cents lower. That on news from F.C. Stone yesterday afternoon on the close. They released a number for the next crop production report from USDA, 3.1 billion bushels strong for the soybeans. That put a lot of pressure on the marketplace today, as did some turnaround after yesterday's gain. In the bean pit, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, about that number, about the USDA's crop progress reports, and, of course, about the F.C. Stone corn number, which was 10.98 billion bushels. Right now, we're looking at a 10-6 crop. So can it grow by another 300 million? We'll find out when USDA releases its next crop production report on the 12th. But we'll try to guess at it as we go into those numbers. Now, let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat futures, 347 and a quarter, to a penny and a half lower for the day. The March contract and the soft red winter wheat at 361 and a half. They were off a penny. And the May futures down three quarters of a cent to 368 and a half. July futures, 373 and a half. They were off three quarters. And the September wheat down a penny and a quarter, 379, the settlement price there. Corn futures December contract, 205 and three quarters. They were down 3 cents today. The March futures off three as well, 218 and a half. And the May contract down two and three quarters at 226 and a quarter. July contract, 233 and a quarter, down two and a half. And SEPs at two and a quarter lower, 239 and three quarters, settlement price. December futures, 249, down two and a quarter. Both the wheat and the corn pit holding pretty strong in the face of what was a pretty rough day in the bean pit today. The oats were up, by the way, 2.5 cents in the nearby December contract there at 164 and three quarters. The March, three higher at 170. November beans for the day, 562 and a half. They had an 18 and a half cent drop today with a high of 69 and a low at 558. January's at 574 and a quarter settlement price. Down 18 and a quarter, had a high of 580 and a half, a low at 571. March futures at 587 and a half high, low at 578 and a half. Settlement price for that March soybean contract down 17 and a quarter at 582 and a quarter. May futures, a 587 and a half settlement price, down 17 cents, the high at 95, the low at 85 for the May beans. July futures, an 18 and a half cent settlement price lower, 592 and a half settled, 599 the high, the low at $5.90. In the August soybeans, down 18 cents at 589 with a high of 596 and a low at $5.88. September's 593 the settlement. They were down 13 with a high of 594 and a low at 592. From the bean meal pit, a settlement price at 163.70, down 360, the high at 165, the low at 162.50. That for the October contract. December bean meal, $168 even, the high, the low at 165.50, settled at 166.70. They were down 410 for the day. And the October bean oil settled at 23.80, off 66 today. 24.20, the high, the low at 23.70. December futures in the bean oil, 24.47 on the high, the low at 23.93. Settlement price there at 24 even, off 65. Now here are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. October feeder cattle, the high today 117.80, the low 116.55, the settlement 117.57 and a half, that up 105. November 116.60, the high 115.45, the low 116.42 and a half, the settlement, that up 102 and a half.